Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. First, I'd like to wish everybody a happy and healthy New Year. And I also like to mention that most of you probably know that through Bodhi Monastery we've been making a collection to help the victims of the tsunami disaster in Sri Lanka. And if you would like to make a donation, it's still possible today. We're at this point, we're entering the data for the receipts, but you can still make a donation if you wish to. If you want to, please see Kathy, who is sitting in the back, after the discussion. Okay, this morning, Master Renshin gave me the responsibility of speaking about the true Dhamma, and he gets all the credit for teaching the lively Dhamma. So I'm supposed to teach the dull, boring true Dhamma. I'm not allowed to tell any jokes. Write any poems. Okay, we have been teaching the Mangala Sutta. This is one of the discourses of the Buddha included in the Sutta Nipata. And last time I started the Sutta, the last class, which was in December, and so before we continue, I'll just give a resume of how the sutta begins. Those of you who are following the series along with the book, the Sutta Nipata, it is on page 29. Okay, the sutta opens when a deva is a deity, a divine being, comes down from one of the deva worlds in the middle of the night, comes down to the Jeta's grove, the monastery established by the wealthy householder Anathapindika for the Buddha. The deva descends in glory, shedding light over the whole monastery, comes down in the presence of the Buddha, bows down to the Buddha, and tells the Buddha a problem that has been obsessing the minds of the gods as well as human beings for a long time. That wishing for their well-being, their safety, their security, they have long considered what constitutes true blessings, true, what is translated here as true auspicious performances. And this deity asked the Buddha, tell us what is the highest, the supreme auspicious performance, or what constitutes the true source of blessings, the true cause of blessings. And then the Buddha, in 10 verses, will explain sequentially, in a graded sequence, the causes for true blessings in life. And I've taken these verses of the Mangala Sutta, and I've put them into a series showing how they form this rated sequence, the 10 verses, within the 10 verses, one finds actually 38 blessings or 38 types of auspicious performance. And so I've grouped them into these different categories as they unfold in the course of the discourse. And you see that this forms a very, very beautiful, very, very carefully designed structure or sequence. And we begin with what I call orientation. And that is in the verse that I explained last time, verse number 2. Not to associate with foolish persons, to associate with wise persons, and to venerate or to honor those who are worthy of veneration. Okay, so these three blessings, these, I say, constitute the conditions for discretion. Discretion, this is a word which means, you could call this practical wisdom. It's wisdom in knowing how to make the right decisions in life. The wisdom how to discriminate, to distinguish what is good from what is bad, what is right from what is wrong, what is truly valuable from what is just superficially attractive, what has a glittering surface, but inside is empty, hollow. And so at the very outset of following this graded course to true wisdom, we have to develop this faculty or capacity for discretion. Because if we're going to carry our way through life, carry on through life successfully, and not only within one life, but from one life to the next through many lives, the most precious asset we can bring with us is this capacity for right moral judgment, this faculty of discretion. If we lack this faculty of discretion, it's very easy to go along the wrong path. Even among those following Buddhism, it's very easy to be hoodwinked by many deceivers who are out to pass off false Dhamma as true Dhamma, to pass off superstitious practices as wholesome practices. So one has to develop a capacity for correct judgment. And the Buddha always emphasizes that one has to be able to judge for oneself, not just depending blindly upon external authorities. But while one is still a spiritual infant or spiritually developing in an early stage, just as the child can't go out and earn its own living but has to depend upon the help, the assistance of the parents, so we have to depend upon the guidance of the right type of person. So we avoid associating with the foolish. And by associating here, it means subordinating ourselves to foolish persons, serving them, treating them as guides. It doesn't mean that we can't have friends who might be a little bit foolish, but it means that we don't look up to them as guides, as teachers, as models to follow. And instead, when we choose our proper friends, our friends, our models, our guides, we look to wise people, to those who already have this faculty of discretion well established within them, those who embody higher virtues, higher wisdom, qualities like kindness, compassion. and who are able to point us along the right path in life. And then we should venerate those who are worthy of veneration. In the Buddhist tradition, above all, that means venerating the Buddhas, venerating the Aryan Sangha, the Sangha which constituted by the noble persons, and venerating wise, enlightened teachers. Okay, so this covers summarizes what I already covered. Now we come to verse number 3 of the sutta. And this verse, in my understanding, is concerned with once we have this orientation by cultivating the conditions for discretion, now we have to establish secure foundations. This is establishing certain other inner and outer requisites for success in life. And so I'll recite the verse in Pali and then translate it and then give explanation. Pati rupa de savaso cha pube cha kata punyata Atta sama panidicha etang mangalamuttamang. Okay, so the first of these requisites for foundations is called dwelling in a suitable locality. Pati rupa desa vasa. And this shows, the fact that the Buddha mentions this shows how much emphasis, how much importance the Buddha places upon the influence of the environment upon our development. In fact, the Buddha in the suttas, he elaborates what are the factors that constitute a suitable locality. And he mentions 4 factors that make up the suitable locality. There has to be a congenial environment in terms of climate, temperature, and so on. There has to be suitable neighbors. There has to be suitable food, and there has to be suitable Dhamma. Okay, there has to be a suitable climate, and when we consider the situation in the world, in America, we take our climate for granted. But if you just look out in the world, you see in so many countries, people spend so much of their time just struggling against the climate. Even if you consider the tsunami, it's not an everyday affair in these countries that were hit. Generally, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, southern Thailand have quite pleasant climates. But still, these are parts of the world which are prone to disastrous conditions. In Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, often there are droughts for long periods. Other parts of the world, and far north, Siberia, one spends so much of the year fighting against the cold. And so to have a relatively mild climate, change of seasons, I can't say that today is exactly an endorsement for the wonders of the American climate, but in the U.S. we have a fairly pleasant climate. Okay, then to have second factor is an abundant supply of different types of food. Okay, this is one of the most important things in life. In fact, one of the essential factors in life is food, that all beings live, subsist on food. The Buddha says if there's one thought that leads to disenchantment, to dispassion, it is the idea that all beings subsist on food. And in the animal realm, the beings in the animal realm spend their entire life, always their one obsessive thought is always to find food. You look at cows, what are the cows doing all the time, and horses? Always they're eating all day long. The dogs and cats, they sit around all day long, somewhat bored, just waiting for the one mealtime in the day to come along. And so food is such an important consideration. And for human beings too, in countries where there is a lack of sufficient food, dearth of food, shortages of food, or lack of nutritious food, food becomes a momentous concern. It's just the thought, the obsessive thought, that keeps one preoccupied all day long. I even had this experience myself in my first years as a monk in Sri Lanka. I was living in a small village temple, and I didn't yet know about going on alms round, because in that temple the monks didn't go on alms round. It's not done customarily in Sri Lanka. And the one food that was served there was just rice. For the morning, it was just a light porridge. The young monk said, I think if you add more water to the porridge, you get more rice. You get more of it, so you get a fuller meal. And the lunch was a meal basically of rice with a light curry on the side. This is a dal of lentils, just with water. And if you add more water to the lentils, you get more of the dish. And once in a while, as a special benefit, you get a banana. that's the special treat once a week or so, one banana. And so this would be my meal for about a month. Then I would go to my teacher and tell him this is very difficult. And he said, oh, don't worry, I'll arrange things. The next day, people will come to my kuti, my cottage. Five course meal, like you've never seen before. Next day, it's down to 3 courses. Next day, to 2 courses. By the third day, I'm going back into the temple kitchen to get my meal of the rice with the dal. And this is going on day after day, so by the time 3 or 4 weeks go by, one is just thinking all the time, as soon as one finishes the meal and digests it, 1 hour later, one is thinking about the next meal. It's not a joking matter. Till there was an Indian monk who was living on the other side of the hill. He was going on alms round, and every day I would go to see him for some time. We would have some discussion. Then one time I went to see him. He asked me, did you see the dogs today? I haven't seen the dogs. I said, no, I didn't see them either. Why? Then he pointed to the corner outside his hut, his cottage. He said, well, I have my leftover food for them. And I looked at him. I looked at the heap of food that he had for them, and it was much more luxurious than I was getting in a week. And I said, wow, how are you getting that? And he said, well, I'm going on alms round. And then finally, I said, well, can you take me along with you? And so then he taught me how to go on alms round. Okay, so this is just one illustration of how important it is to have a sufficient supply of adequate food to keep the body well nourished. This is part of a suitable location. Okay, so suitable food, and then having suitable neighbors, to be living in a suitable community with, where you have the opportunity to associate with good people. This is because people influence us very much. And so if one is living in a neighborhood in which there's a lot of crime, then you're always anxious and worried about robbery, about being attacked by criminals. If there's a lot of, say, alcoholism, a lot of people drinking in the neighborhood, drug addicts in the neighborhood. Again, if you have children, you're always concerned about your children coming under their influence. But if you're living in a community of good people, virtuous people, then that will give you a sense of ease, of comfort, and it will also promote the well-being of your family. And then the fourth important aspect about the locality is called good Dhamma, suitable Dhamma. And this can be understood in two ways. It's explained in the commentaries in two ways. One is in terms of the worldly Dhamma, having a country, neighborhood, and area in which there is law and order. This is taking the word Dhamma in its secular sense as law, order, in which there is the rule of a proper government. Especially it will be a country, an area in which the people in the government themselves embody virtuous qualities and can serve as a model, an example for the people in the country. And so they will themselves exemplify virtues, and the laws that they pass will be laws that are truly beneficial to the country. They will not be draconian laws, oppressive laws, laws that exploit the country, that exploit the people for their own benefits. And then the other aspect about suitable Dhamma is in the area in which one is living, one has access to the teaching of the Buddha's Dhamma. That is, one has access to temples, monasteries, where you can learn the teaching of the Buddha. Okay, so these are all factors which go together to make dwelling in a suitable locality. To sum up, you're dwelling in a place in which there's a suitable climate, congenial climate. You have sufficient supply of food and other material requisites. You have a good community, good neighbors, and you have a society which is governed by law and order, and in which you have access to Buddhist teachings. Okay, the second important foundation now is called Pubbekatapunyata, which means merits done in the past. This means that for successful achievement in this life, one has to have brought along with one meritorious accumulations from earlier lives. And this raises the important question, what is meant by this word merit? The Pali word is punya, is the Chinese word fu. Okay, the word merit, it's a word which is easily misunderstood people think it means that you just can practice certain rites, certain rituals mechanically, and thereby you're assured of good luck. You go into the temple, you bow down a few times before statues, you recite certain mantras, or you perform certain sutras, you don't even know what you're reciting, and thereby you recite them a certain number of times, 10 times, 100 times, or you have a set of beads and you can go through the rosary, the mala, do it 100 times a day, 1,000 times a day, and thereby you get so much merit. But the word punya actually means, literally, it's that which cleanses and purifies the stream of the mind. And it refers to a certain power, a capacity in wholesome deeds. The power, the capacity of wholesome deeds to produce beneficial results for oneself within the course of samsara, within the course of birth and death. Now, any ethically, morally significant action that we perform originates from volition. Volition is what we call chaitana in Pali. And so chaitana, volition, is a factor of the mind. And when this volition is accompanied by clear understanding, by the force of intention, then that volition will have a certain impact upon the nature of our mind. So when we perform unwholesome deeds, then those volitions have a kind of negative impact on the mind. They leave negative impressions on the mind. They have obstructive influences upon the mind. Whereas when we perform wholesome karma, wholesome actions, those volitions have a clarifying impact on the mind. They illuminate the mind, lighten the mind. And we can, if one is very attentive to one's state of mind, one can feel that lightening, illuminating influence on the mind at the very moment one is performing the wholesome action. But also, that wholesome karma deposits, I'm speaking metaphorically, it deposits in the mind a certain wholesome power, an illuminating power, a beneficial power, which remains in the mind and has the capacity to bring beneficial fruits in life after life after life. And it is through our wholesome actions that we acquire this merit, and it is this merit which serves as the basis for achieving all of the basic goals that human beings take to be desirable. Why is it that some people, for example, are wealthy, others are poor? It's because they have accumulated meritorious karma leading to wealth. Why is it that some people have long lives, others short lives? The ones who have long lives have accumulated the meritorious karma leading to a long life. Why is it that some people have radiantly good health all the ways through life, never have to see a doctor, even if they live to be 100? Others have to see doctors for one illness after another illness. They're always ill, one thing after another. They don't have that meritorious karma. Some people are very beautiful, lovely. Again, that's through merit. Others get strong influence over others. Again, that comes through the power of merit. So all of these desirable goals of human beings come about through merit. It's through meritorious karma that one comes into the human realm of existence. Anyone who is reborn a human being is reborn as a human through the impact, through the ripening of merit, meritorious karma. But there are thousands and thousands of gradations of meritorious karma. So one might be reborn as a human being, but one might be reborn in a country which is afflicted with poverty, with civil war, with bad climate, with famine. In that case, there isn't enough merit to support the fulfillment of the other goals. One might be reborn in a very prosperous country, reborn into a rich family, reborn under conditions where one gets everything one might want, but one is afflicted with chronic illness from the time one is born. Again, one has many, many, many types of meritorious karma, but something is deficient. Again, it's through merit that one comes into contact with the Buddha's teaching. It's through performing meritorious deeds connected with the Buddha Dhamma that we are able to come into association with the Buddha Dhamma. So, when one goes for refuge to the Triple Gem, that is a meritorious deed. That is a meritorious deed that connects one to the Buddha's Dhamma, so that life after life, one is able to meet the Buddha Dhamma. If one just is interested in Buddhism, reads a lot about it, appreciates it, but one doesn't take the going for refuge, then one is not building up that meritorious connection with the Buddha Dhamma, and one might lose it from one life to the next. The Buddhist teachers, at least in the Theravada tradition, have enumerated, we call 10 bases of merit. That's 10 ways of acquiring meritorious deeds. The first one is giving or generosity. I'm just going to enumerate them, not to explain. The second is undertaking precepts, virtue, moral virtue. The third is bhavana, meditation. The fourth is reverence, that is showing respect to those who are worthy of respect. The fifth is service, so that those who do, for example, volunteer service for monastery or for other Buddhist organizations are acquiring meritorious karma that will be beneficial to them in future lives. The next one is called sharing one's merits with others. Sometimes it's translated transference of merit. But actually, literally, one cannot actually take one's own merits and literally transfer them to others. But what one does is to generate the wish, the intention of sharing one's merits with others. And one radiates the wish that others might rejoice in one's merits, and thereby one is extending the range of one's meritorious deeds as if the merit can be transferred to others. The seventh base of merit is rejoicing in the merits of others. That is, when one learns about others who do meritorious deeds, one rejoices in their merits. Or just in general, one thinks about all the meritorious deeds that others might have done, might be doing, and one rejoices in their merits instead of feeling envious, feeling jealous. One thinks with joy that these meritorious deeds will bring them happiness and well-being. And in this way, one generates a wholesome thought within oneself. The eighth base of merit is listening to the Dhamma. So when you hear the Dhamma, listen to it, study the Dhamma, that is also creating merit. The ninth is teaching the Dhamma. And the tenth is straightening out one's views, straightening one's understanding. And this is studying the Dhamma with the aspect of gaining wisdom and practicing insight meditation in order to come to understand through direct experience the real nature of things. And then when it comes to meritorious deeds, there are four ways that one can go about this, mentioned in the text. The first way is one simply performs meritorious deeds oneself, but one doesn't make any effort to encourage others to perform the meritorious deeds. This the Buddha praises as being worthy, but not the most worthy way to behave. The second is one encourages others to perform meritorious deeds, but one doesn't perform the meritorious deeds oneself. This, the Buddha says, is praiseworthy in one respect, but the person had better start getting down and doing meritorious deeds himself, otherwise his own life is useless for his own good. The third approach is one doesn't do any meritorious deeds oneself, doesn't encourage others to do them. This person, the Buddha says, is one who is a loser in both ways. This is the person who's just heading downwards completely. And the fourth way is one does meritorious deeds oneself, and one encourages others to do meritorious deeds. That is the way the Buddha says, that is the best way, the superior way. Okay, so merit done in the past life, in our past lives, this provides an important supporting condition for well-being and happiness in this life. But the merit that is done in the past comes to fruition in the present in dependence upon certain conditions. It's like a power stored up in the past, somewhat like the power in an electric power plant. We have the power of the electricity, say it's always coming through the power lines of this building. But if we don't turn on the switch of this light, and we come into the room and we say, gee, it's dark in here. I can't read here. You know, it's just my luck. I have bad luck, whatever room I come into. Always dark. I can't understand it. You know, some people have luck. I see them in their rooms. They're in their rooms. They have bright lights. I go from one room to another, always dark. What do we say to this person? The power is there. You have to make the effort. Turn on the light. Well, it's like a few weeks ago, I was sitting in the library there. My library, very cold, working with my computer, thinking it's really cold here. Everybody else is in their room. They're all comfy and warm. And fortunately, Venerable Shinshin comes in, walks over to the heater, turns it on. Then I think, wow, now it's getting warm in here. Okay, so to get the power of that merit, one has to make the effort. And to start to make the effort, one has to begin with setting oneself on the right course. This is called right resolution of the self. Atta samma panidicca. And so if we don't make any determination to follow a good, wholesome way of life, then the supporting conditions of that merit, certain types of merits will bring their results anyway. Just through the conditions of the birth. For example, many people are born in affluent countries, born into wealthy families, born under, and they always meet success in life. That's because they have some very powerful meritorious conditions, which are just bringing their results anyway. Or else they're making the effort, but it's an effort which it's helping that karma to mature, even though they might not be creating new meritorious karma in this life. But what we have to do is to direct our will, our volition, our intentions in a way which will help the merits from the past to mature and also enable us in this life to be able to create new meritorious conditions for future lives. So I mentioned the 10 ways of meritorious karma just before, the 10 bases of merits. So we should make the resolution, the determination to follow those 10 ways of meritorious action. Okay, then I'll now come to the next verse, which I'll try to treat very concisely. This is verse number 4. Bahu sa chancha si pancha Vinayo cha su sikito subhasita cha yavacha Etang Mangalamuttamam. Okay, this verse I call the verse dealing with preparations. And this, I say, is concerned with training oneself for success in life. And here we have a well-rounded education, or in the words of the text, a good all-round education. Then I would take sipa to be learning a craft or profession, though the translator has appreciation of the arts. Then a code of discipline that has been well trained in. That's a highly trained discipline. And then he has pleasant speech, but I would say well-spoken speech, well-spoken statements. Okay, so now once one has the proper orientation through a sense of discretion, once one has these secure foundations, one has to prepare oneself in life by getting a well-rounded education. Here the Pali word bahusaccha means literally listening to much. So since in the days of the Buddha, people learned by listening. So one would listen to many teachings, one studies, whatever field one specializes in, one learns deeply, thoroughly, and broadly, but one tries to get as broad an education as one can before one specializes. So one has a broad mind, just not a very narrow and specialized mind. Then, in order to be able to earn one's living in life, one has to learn a certain profession. In the days of the Buddha, most people were either in agriculture, or those who were professional people earned their living through a craft. And so they became craftsmen. They would study a craft under a master. And so the word for craft is almost the same for the word for an art. Just as we have in English the word artisan, which was originally a type of artist, but then comes to mean a craftsman. Then comes a code of discipline that has been well trained in by many and that has proved itself to be a viable code of discipline, one that has stood the test of time. And the text uses the word vinaya here. Usually vinaya is understood to mean the code of discipline for monastics. But I understand that this part of the sutta has a much broader range than simply the monastic order. So I take this to be vinaya in the widest sense, that code of discipline which all followers of the Dhamma should adhere to as the minimum. And that would be the five precepts: to abstain from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, false speech, and the use of intoxicants. I will have occasion to elaborate on these later in the course of the sutta. And then well-spoken speech. This is a factor upon which the Buddhist texts put a lot of importance, because even though speech is just one faculty, but it plays such a tremendous role in human life. If one considers how many arguments, disputes arise through human speech, how many lives have been injured and hurt through falsehoods, through lies, and how much benefit can arise when people use their faculty of speech for healing divisions, for speaking the truth, for communicating what is of value and benefit to others. Okay, so when we speak, when we're going to speak, we have to give a lot of attention to the way we speak. And so the Buddhist texts lay down certain criteria that we should bear in mind before we speak, when we're considering speaking. And we have to really train ourselves to be able to incorporate these criteria into our minds and use them as guidelines for speech. Otherwise, we chatter and chatter without saying what is really meaningful. So these criteria are, first, when we're going to speak, our statements should be true, not false. Then, when we're going to speak, our speech should be gentle, not harsh and bitter. Then, when we're going to speak, our speech should be such that it doesn't create divisions or conflicts between others, but rather it unites those who are divided. And fourth, we don't engage in just gossip and idle chatter, but we try to speak what is meaningful, what is valuable. And when we practice restraining our speech and adhering to these guidelines to right speech, we find that our speech gains a certain power of conviction over others. This is, I call this almost a magical or magnetic power of speech. People who like to chatter, chit-chat all the time, gossip, their speech, when they speak, it doesn't have any drawing power. Other people listen, but their speech just comes in one ear, goes out the other, or it bounces off the first ear, doesn't even go into the mind and out the other ear. But when one practices restraining the speech, then the mind builds up a certain power of silence. And that power of silence in the mind is able to, in a sense, drift down to the vocal cords, so that when one does have to speak, the speech will have a compelling power, a convincing power, which, of course, one should use for the good and benefit of others, not just to win friends and influence people. The fact that one should avoid harsh speech doesn't mean that one should never criticize others. There are times when one has to criticize other people. But when one criticizes others, again, one has to set up the right frame of mind. And what I like about the Buddhist texts is that they always enumerate the factors for any particular situation. So we have these very neat numerical lists. I don't like to bore you with lists, but it's useful to have things enumerated. Bop, bop, bop. Okay, when one has to criticize another person, then this is the way one does it. First, one has to consider, is my criticism going to be true or false? That is, say one has heard something about another person, that so-and-so has done this. Before one pulls up the other person to criticize him, we have to find out, have you really done this? Even though the Buddha is said to have been omniscient, when other people would make complaints to the Buddha about a certain monk, the Buddha will say, tell Venerable so-and-so to come see me. The messenger will come, call that monk in front of the Buddha. The Buddha doesn't begin right away by criticizing that monk. But the Buddha will say to that monk, say it's Ananda, Ananda, so-and-so Revata has said this about you. Is this true? The Buddha himself will ask that monk, is it true? So one has to be sure that one is criticizing the person on true grounds. Of course, if one has seen it for oneself, then one doesn't have to get verification from others. Okay, then when one is going to criticize, one has to set up in one's mind the thought of loving kindness or compassion towards that person, so that one doesn't have anger or hatred in one's mind. Then when one expresses oneself, one should do so with gentle words, not with harsh words. Sometimes the words won't be agreeable and pleasant to the other person, but the tone of voice should be gentle, not angry and scolding the person. Then one has to be sure that what one is going to say to the person must be beneficial to the person, useful. If you just scold the person, blame the person, criticize the person with one fault after another, that's not really saying what is beneficial. Rather, one should point out the person's faults and then show the person a way to improve himself, or show the person another way to do maybe the job that he's been doing, that would be a more effective way to do it. And then the fifth standard that one has to set up in one's mind in speaking to the person is to speak at the right time. If one wants to criticize a person and the person is, say, with a group of friends or you're with the crowd and it's a very sensitive matter, then you don't criticize that person in front of the crowd so that the person will feel very hurt and embarrassed. But rather, you wait to you get the person alone and you can speak to him privately, speak to her privately. That's the right time. Or say the person is, maybe your son or daughter is about to go off to take final exam at school, and you have to criticize the that your son or daughter for some mistake done in the household. Don't criticize just before going, the son or daughter goes off to take the final exam, because that will disturb the child's mind, and then the child can't concentrate on the exam and won't do well. Wait till the child comes home after taking the exam, then let everything loose. Okay, so that will be my presentation for this afternoon. I thank you all for your attention, and may the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. We share the merits. Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata devanagamahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam etavata chamehi sampadam punyasampadam Sabbe deva anumodantu, sabba sampatti siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.